Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. Transform your home with the warmth of an Irish-made kitchen. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Helen McEntee, Minister for Education and Youth, and Fine Gael TD from Meath East is here with me in the studio. Good morning to you. You're welcome. So we just have this announcement for you, from you this morning on teacher training. So you're writing to the Teaching Council today. You want all teachers to complete placements in special education settings and then the modules, the training modules to back that up. Why?
Because quite simply, I think it's absolutely imperative that every single teacher knows how to support every single child in their classroom. And that doesn't just mean teachers in mainstream, it means teachers who are in special education classrooms and then obviously teachers who are working in special schools. So at the moment, there is a certain level of training. If you go in to become a teacher, you're in your training, there's a certain level that focuses on additional needs that students might have. But I believe that there needs to be more. So if you think of the fact that we have a huge focus at the moment, and rightly so, in making sure that we have enough classroom spaces for young people. So we're developing new educational classrooms where the focus is specifically children with additional educational needs. We have special schools. You have so many young people as well with additional needs who are in mainstream. Mm-hmm. So no matter where you are teaching, it should be the case that every teacher knows how to support that child, what that additional need might be. And at the moment, I don't feel that that's the case.
Right. So that need isn't being met as far as you're concerned with the training that's there at the moment.
And it's not that teachers don't want to. So I'm meeting teachers who want to be able to provide that support for young people. But we need to make sure that the training is there. So if you're out in a placement, you should be making sure the part of that placement is in either an additional educational classroom or in a special school. But that's also complemented and supported by the modules when you're back in your college, when you're back doing your training. Okay. For the rest of the time
of the year. So along with this request then to the Teaching Council, will there be additional resources given to the teacher training institutions?
Well, whatever is needed. So what we need to do first is assess what is needed, what level of training has been provided, what would new modules look like, and how would we make sure that every person had the ability to do that placement. So we need to make sure the spaces are there and the time is there to do it. So I've asked them to look at that, what is needed, whether it's additional resources, whether it's a change in the curriculum, and how do we set out a structure that would incorporate into what's already taking place at the moment, that this would be ready for 2026.
Right.
So this won't happen overnight. This will take a little bit of time, but it is absolutely, if we're looking at the fact that there are more children being diagnosed, we know there are more children being diagnosed with additional needs. We know that that's only going to increase. I need to make sure that every single teacher that is coming out of teacher training is equipped to support the child in whatever way they need. And that's really the focus here. It's making sure that every single child, whether they're in mainstream, whether they're in a special education classroom as part of mainstream, or whether they're in a special school, that teachers are equipped and that they themselves feel confident to provide that support.
There may be parents listening to this who wonder whether this is a move towards having children with additional needs in mainstream classrooms across the board, because all teachers will be capable of teaching them now. Is that an aim here?
This is to make sure that there is choice and that every teacher, irrespective of where they're teaching, that they have that level of capacity and capability. So at the moment, there's 97% of our students, many of whom have additional educational needs, are being taught in mainstream classrooms. Yet I think the view is that unless you're in a special education classroom or a special school, you don't necessarily need any extra training or any additional support. But if 97% of our students are in mainstream classrooms, then absolutely it should be the case that teachers have a level of understanding, have a level of capacity to be able to teach children who have additional needs. So my objective, and I said this the moment I went into the department, is that every child, irrespective of who they are, where they live, what school they go to, that they have access to the education that they're entitled to, and that parents have choice if they want, or if it's the case that their child needs to be in a special school, that they have access to a special school in their area, within their vicinity, if it's a classroom or if it's mainstream. And, you know, there's thousands of children that are being supported in mainstream schools at the moment through SNAs, through special education teachers, through hubs that are being developed in the schools where there's a mixture of both. You might be in a classroom with 30 students. You might be on your own for some of the day as well with a particular SNA or a teacher. It's about choice. Mm-hmm. It's about what's best for the child. And that's the overall objective
and
here.
The Is there another objective to reduce the number of SNAs that we currently need? If you have that need being met by the teachers who have the training, they will be graduating, I suppose, in 2030 if it comes in, the school, the
no,
training
schools. No, absolutely
not.
This is to complement. So, I mean, at the moment we have just over 30,000 SNAs. I think it's about 21,000. And then you have about 9,000 special education teachers. That complements the almost 80,000 teachers we have across mainstream. So this is to complement the work that each one of those are doing, but it's to acknowledge the fact that there are young people in mainstream who need that a bit of additional support, but they don't necessarily need to be in a classroom that is specifically designated for children mm-hmm. with additional needs. They don't need to be in a special school. So again, this is about choice. This is about acknowledging there are different types of needs, but it's also about making sure that teachers feel confident. So as we roll out more classrooms, so for example, over the last number of years, we have significantly increased the number of special education classrooms. We need to make sure that every teacher can teach in those classrooms. So if you have a primary school where there's only four teachers, you know, a smaller rural area, it won't be the case that a teacher sticks with one classroom forever.
Will be trained.
Everybody
in this
will
area.
Be trained. Everybody will be able to teach in whatever classroom they're allocated by their principal. And it's not just for the bigger schools, it's
okay.
for the smaller schools.
Do you have an
as
indication as to how the unions feel about this yet? Or what do you expect in that regard?
Well, do you know, I've met with the majority of the unions in the last number of weeks, and they are as focused on providing children with additional needs the supports that they need. And what I got as feedback from the unions is that for many teachers, I won't say they're afraid, but they're concerned that if they're asked to teach in a classroom where it's only children with additional needs, that they won't be able to, that they don't have the capacity and that they won't be able to provide them with the best teaching and the best learning that they want to give them. So that is the feedback that I got very strongly, that teachers don't necessarily always feel confident in providing that education. So this is about, at the very outset, saying it's just the norm. It's part and parcel. Mm-hmm. It's what you learn when you're in college. And when you go out into a school setting, irrespective of where you are or the type of school setting, you are equipped to provide that education
and
to every young person.
You won't be paid extra for providing education for children with special needs.
Well, if it's just part of your day to day, if it's part of the training that you provide, and if we know that so many young children have additional needs, then it becomes part and parcel. So I think this has to be seen.
But do you expect there'll be a request for an allowance with this additional element to their training?
But I think we have to look at it differently. I think if we're starting to separate it out, then we're missing the point here. This has to be
standard,
just part and parcel standard, uh-huh. that if you are training to become a teacher, you know that there are going to be children in your classroom, whether it's mainstream, whether it's an additional educational classroom, or whether it's a special school, that there is going to be children that need that extra requirement.
OK, well, listen, let's move on. And we will be getting response and reaction from unions later in the programme. Now, your party leader in Taoiseach, Simon Harris, last week said that that programme, Adolescence, on Netflix, which has just had so much attention over the last week, he wants it to be mandatory viewing in secondary schools. Do you agree with him?
I think it could be shown, yes. I mean, the structure and the way we set it up is that every school decides what they want to do, whether it's in the curricula, the books they use. I've watched it myself, and yes, I think it's absolutely compelling viewing. I think it's very upsetting, the topic itself that it focuses on, and knowing that the writer wrote it because of the fact that there had been a number of deaths similar in the UK, and we've seen more and more of this. Mm-hmm. To me, what stood out the most about this is that we need to be talking to our young people and engaging with them in what is going on in their lives, and in particular in the way in which they're communicating via technology. I mean, every cohort of young people through the ages, we've had our own ways of engagement, we've had our own different challenges. Technology has obviously become front and centre for mm-hmm. a young person's life. And what stood out to me the most, I think it was episode 2, where the policeman who was going around the school, his son pulled him aside and he said, you're missing the point here. You're seeing one thing, whereas young people know that this is something completely different.
With what the emojis meant.
The emojis,
so on.
What everything meant. And I think we need to talk to young people. We need to engage with them. We need to understand what they're going through. And we need to support them and to try mm-hmm. and show them this is how you can cope with challenges. This is how you cope with adversity. But also that we push back on this awful narrative that unless you're a certain type of man or a certain type of girl, then you're not conforming and you're not fitting the norm.
But I'm sure teachers, Minister, have told you that they're having to deal on a daily basis with online bullying, and it's taking up a lot of time in schools and a lot of headspace. I mean, what do they do and how can you support schools in dealing with that?
So my focus as Minister for Education is to make sure that, firstly, education and schools, it's a setting where children learn, where they feel that they are focused on, well, how do I plan for my future? Now, part of that is addressing issues around bullying, technology, sexual health and education. How do we prepare young people, not just for the workforce, but for life in general? SPHE, the reform of the curriculum, is really important in that regard. And there's been a huge amount of work done over the last number of years looking at how we reform this particular subject and this particular area of focus. How do we engage with young people around what's a healthy relationship? How do we engage with young people around bullying? What's appropriate, what's not? How do we support young people to navigate social media in a world where it has now become part and parcel of their life? We wouldn't have needed that 10 years ago or 15 years ago because that was not part of their day-to-day life.
Also, right now,
equipping teachers, putting in place specific time in the week so that we can actually focus on this and talk to young people and support
And that's
them.
One side of it. That's prevention. But with what's happening now, and like I said to you, the time that has to be spent by principals, assistant principals and teachers dealing with bullying incidents that are happening, like, do you think the department has a role in supporting schools in that regard?
Absolutely. And there are a number of things that I want to see happen. So firstly, I want to make sure that the SPHE and the ORC curriculums are mandatory. They're part and parcel of every young person's weekly school profile and programme, so that we have a set time where teachers are sitting down and they're going through, well, what are the challenges young people are facing? We need to make sure that teachers are supported as well and making sure that they're able to deal with that. I mean, I've had teachers say to me, I have young people coming up with problems that I'm not sure how to deal with. We are now part and parcel as well as teaching. We have to be able to support them emotionally with things that are going on in their lives. So we need to make sure that they're supported as well. But one of the biggest things, and this comes back to the fact that so much of that programme Adolescence focuses on what's happening on our phones. You know, we can say we'll ban them. Children shouldn't have access to social media. I'm not sure that's the right approach. But in the school setting, which is what I'm responsible for, where children should be learning, where they should be focused, where they should be engaging with each other, I do think removing phones at that instance is the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. And the phone pouches, while it's been controversial or while people have had their views on it, it's one way in which we can try and reduce the amount of time that young people are spending on their phones, but in particular when they're in schools, when they should be learning, when they should be interacting with each other, when they should be engaging with each other. And I think beyond that, then, we all have a responsibility. I mean, I'm a parent. I have two young boys. It's going to be a long time, I hope, before I have to maybe think about them having phones or interacting on social media.
You'd be surprised, because there are children in first and second class who have phones now, you know, and the pressure starts at that point.
Absolutely. And I'll be very honest, I don't think any child should have a mobile phone or access to social media while they're in primary school. That is my personal view, and that's something that I will hope to apply in my own personal situation. But, you know, beyond that, what my children will be using in 10 or 15 years' time in terms of technology or social media, I don't know. It's changing at such a fierce rate. But what I do want to know is that I can, as a parent, and that when they're in school, supported by their teachers, that we provide them with the right level of support and guidance and advice as to how to deal with the challenges that they're going to face.
Yeah,
where we are now, that's what we're trying to do.
But I still come back to the teachers and the principals who are having to deal with this on a daily basis. And, you know, the social media companies, do you feel that more pressure should be put on them through regulation? Because they're the ones who are hosting this stuff.
Well, can I just say, we're one of the first countries in Europe to introduce our online safety commissioner. So this is a new commission where their sole focus and responsibility is looking at social media companies, harmful content, having it removed. And if companies don't remove content that's been identified as harmful, that they are fined and that there are significant fines. That work is already happening. The commission is already set up. They've put in place their codes of conduct. And I expect to see, I hope, in the next couple of months and in the next few years, them having a real positive impact. So we need to do more with social media companies. And I think that's a really positive step. For my role as Minister for Education, I want to see that we have in our schools a focus on supporting young people, making sure that they have the right environment to be able to learn, to focus, to engage with each other. Mm-hmm. So I've spoken to schools where they've introduced phone bans, where they've introduced phone pouches already. And the response that I've gotten from teachers in particular, but also from parents, is that children are more engaged. They're more engaged at lunchtime. They're talking to each other. They're not sitting on their phones and they're more focused when it comes to their classroom setting. Right. I need to make sure that that is the case for every single child. So if it means phone pouches, it's an option for schools. We're not making it mandatory, but they can identify that this is a need. We're going to put in place pouches. We're going to try and remove phones from students during the day. But we also need to make sure that we're not just, you know, pretending a problem doesn't exist, that we're through the SPHE and the RSE curriculum. We're talking to young people on the prevention side as well.
Do you think there's ever a role for the Gardaí here? If there's a particularly serious case of online bullying that a school is having to deal with, that it's brought to the attention of the school that a child is being bullied by somebody else in that school, should they call the guards?
Well, it's already happening. So the very first law that I ever introduced in the Department of Justice was Coco's Law. And this might seem something abstract and removed from school, but it actually came about because of a school child who was being bullied, where there was harmful content being shared, where there were intimate images being shared. And this legislation and this now new law makes it a crime to share such images. Mm-hmm. You'll have seen campaigns, be it on our TV screens and our radio, trying to highlight in particular to young people that this is an offence. And if you commit this type of crime, then the guard might appear at your door and you might be prosecuted. So it has already gotten to the point where there are certain types of offences being committed in schools and between young people where they are crimes and where there are very, very serious penalties at the end of the day. What you want to do is highlight this. So as part and parcel of Coco's Law, there was a massive campaign, not just on our TV screens and on newspapers, but in schools to highlight this to young people, that these are very serious offences and that there are very serious consequences at the end of the day. Now, thankfully, since Coco's Law was introduced, we've seen an uptake in the number of people who have made complaints. They've brought it to Hotline, which is one of the organisations we work with in partnering to try and deal with harmful content online. For the most part, this type of content has been removed, which is what a lot of people want. And in some instances, it has ended up with prosecutions. So that's the very extreme end of it. That's not where you want to get to with 12 or 13 or 14 year olds. But it's really important, again, through our teaching and our training in schools, that we highlight that these types of behaviours can be criminal behaviours.
Listen, let's move on, because many people who will be sitting the Leaving Cert want to know when they're going to get their results. Do you know?
When they're going to get the results for this year?
Yeah.
They'll be getting them in August, I hope, or as soon as possible.
Because they have been since COVID, you know, they have been quite late. And for people who are hoping to get accommodation then for college, it puts them in a very difficult position.
And I fully understand where they're coming from. So I've directed my officials when I came into the department at the outset to make sure that we have this addressed, I suppose, and that we have results for students as early as possible.
Okay, but it will be in August. You just don't have the date.
I don't have the exact date, but the intention is that it would be early August, but as early as possible to allow students to be able to plan.
And we are expecting inflated grades now to drop for the first time in 5 years. And that'll put the class of 2025 at a disadvantage when it comes to students from other years who might be applying for college places against them. Are you expecting legal cases?
Look, I think what we need to do is try and get back to a place to where we were prior to COVID. So we've seen over the last number of years with COVID, and for obvious reasons, I think, in terms of the challenges around students sitting exams, the fact that we needed to provide different options for students, that grades have been slightly inflated over the last number of years. What I'm hoping to do and what I want to do is to start to regularise and to start to level out essentially some of those inflated grades. So that's starting this year. It's not going to be something that happens in 1 year. This is something that we need to do across a number of years so that you don't see that massive impact and that there isn't, to your point, a huge number of students who feel that they've been negatively impacted by this change. But we do have to bring it back to where we were prior to COVID. We need to start. But again, I want to start from a position where it's a small change, that it's a gradual change, that it happens over time, and that as few students as possible are impacted by it.
I just want to touch on the school meals programme. I know the Department of Social Protection are in charge of that, but are you supportive of children getting a hot meal in school, even though some of the choices there are not as healthy as they could be?
100%. Claire, I cannot stress how important this programme has been for so many students. And I mean, one of the areas that I have said very clearly I want to focus on, it's supporting children who come from disadvantaged backgrounds, supporting children who perhaps don't have the resources, who don't have, you know, hot meals essentially when they're going to school every day. And by providing those hot school meals, you're immediately making sure that certain children are coming to school and that when they're in school, they're able to focus. They're able to focus on their schoolwork and that they have full bellies. We all know if we're hungry, we can't think properly. It's hard to concentrate.
Could the meals be better though?
Look, absolutely. I think in some circumstances, and I think in some areas, you know, it varies depending on who's providing the school meal. But we can improve that. We can adapt that. We can make sure that we work with either the schools or providers to make sure that we have the most nutritious meals possible. And in fact, I've already started conversations with people who are working in this space around food nutrition. My own department and social protection have been talking on this programme overall over the last number of weeks. But I mean, the programme itself, there's not one person I've spoken to, even if they are saying that we need to do better around the nutrition, there's not one person that has said this is not a good programme, this is not something that we should keep. Mm-hmm. As I said, there are children, and I hate to say it, there are some children going to school without breakfast, without lunch, and this means that they are getting nutritious food for the most part, that they're able to concentrate and focus in school, and that has been the number one objective here. It's also really handy for a lot of parents as well. It's, you know, takes away a pressure, particularly those where you have families that are working, where, you know, we have busy households.
Well, they're still under pressure with the quite short day for a primary school. I mean, have you in mind that day could be extended at all at primary school? I mean, there are many countries where children are in school till 3 or 3:30. In Ireland, it can be 2 or 20 past 2.
Well, what I'd like to see more of is that our school settings are used for longer. So it's already the case that in certain school settings, in particular primary schools, you have after school care, you have different programmes being rolled out. In our secondary schools, you have after school learning, you have adult education learning. It's really important that our school settings, where we have invested hundreds of millions of euros into capital buildings, into projects, that we use those buildings for as long as possible during the day. But importantly, that to your point, parents who are working, who perhaps can't get off at 2 o'clock or 3 o'clock to pick up their children, that they have somewhere that their children can go to. And obviously, the less they move around, if it's in the same building, if it's in the same school, all the better.
Mm. So, but there not a longer school day. You're not saying that?
No, I'm not. I'm not proposing that. But I do think that we have a lot of empty classrooms at 3 o'clock in the afternoon and even 4 o'clock in the afternoon that could be used well into the evening when there's so much investment has gone into it by the state. Mm-hmm. It would also be really important to do everything that we can. And I want to support parents who are working as well, that they have somewhere that their children can go to, that they know they're safe, and that obviously, as I said, it's in the same building as where they've been in school earlier on in the day.
I wanted to ask you about the speaking rights row that's happening in the Dáil. It's expected to come to a head now again tomorrow when the Dáil resumes. The opposition say, as we know, it's an affront to democracy. They've written to Micheál Martin in that regard. So the plan tomorrow, the government time, will be used to push through changes to the rules of the Dáil. Is that the plan? Like, to grant speaking rights to Michael Lowry and Danny Healy-Ray and Barry Hennigan and Gillian Toole. Is that what will happen?
Well, I'll tell you what will happen tomorrow. And, you know, I would love for the opposition to say what an affront to democracy is happening here, because there's not a single second of time is going to be taken away from their speaking rights. Not a single second of time is going to be taken away from their ability to put down motions, to ask questions. What is happening is that we are making sure that if you are a government backbencher, so somebody that is elected the same as any other person in opposition, that you actually have a chance to speak, to raise questions. So, for example, if you were a government backbencher back in 2015 or 16, we have what are called private members' motions. Opposition parties can put down motions, pieces of legislation on any issue or topic they want. Government would have had a third of that speaking time. So it meant that not just ministers could speak, but if you were a TD who was elected, you weren't a minister, but you're in government, you could speak about that issue and raise concerns that your constituents had elected you to do so. If you're a government backbencher now, irrespective of who you are or what party you're in, you've about 15% of the time. So over time, less and less time has been given to government speakers, and opposition party is getting more. But what we're saying is we're not going to remove any of their time. We're not removing a single second from opposition, even though that's what they would have everyone believe. We are making sure that there is fairness across the board. And if you are somebody that has been elected, if you're in government or you're in opposition, you will have an ability to raise a question, to raise a concern that your constituents have elected you to do so.
So how do
that
you
is
see,
all that we are
do
doing
you see
here?
Michael Lowry and the others then? Are you saying that they will be treated as government backbenchers now?
They would be the same as anybody else. So at the moment, if you are a government backbencher, you do not have as much speaking rights or time as if you were in opposition. Mm. Now, if you look at any
but
other
it's a really
country,
important
I mean, you
distinction
look
because if Michael Lowry is treated as an opposition TD, he could be chair of the Public Accounts Committee, for example.
Well, firstly, we have no committees because the opposition have delayed this for 2 months. So we started this conversation on the 23rd of January. It's now 2 months later. We have no committees. Opposition have brought forward no legislation, even though they've had countless opportunities to do so through their private members.
The opposition would say it was the government who allowed, you know, this group of independent TDs to, you wanted them to sit on both sides of the house, essentially.
What this is about is fairness. So, as I said, if you are a government TD, you do not have the same speaking rights as if you were in opposition. Now, I don't see how that is logical. If you look at the UK, I mean, a member who is on the government side can ask the Prime Minister a question. It's the norm. It happens in most other countries. What opposition here would have you believe is that if you are a government backbencher, you shouldn't be able to ask any questions. You shouldn't have as much speaking time, even though government is the majority and even though people have been democratically elected the same.
If the opposition walk out tomorrow, what happens?
I mean, really, is that what we're talking about here? That opposition parties would walk out even though they're losing no speaking time, even though there's absolutely no impact on their ability to conduct their business. Government wants to get on with the business of the day. We are absolutely focused on the cost of living, which is still an issue. As Minister for Education...
And will you just guillotine legislation? If they do walk out, will you just carry on without them?
So this isn't legislation. This is a vote in the Dáil that it's taken 2 months to get to
the point where we're voting on this.
With
the business of the houses, will you just carry on without them and guillotine stuff and get it through?
Why would they not turn up? I mean, this, they're talking about an affront to democracy. This government has been democratically elected. We have been democratically elected as a government now. And to say that they will walk out because they don't like the fact that we want backbenchers to be able to have a voice in government. You have less time to speak as a government backbencher now than if you did 10 years ago.
Well, listen,
we are not taking any time off opposition, even though they would have you believe that. So, you know, I think it would be an affront to democracy if they walk out tomorrow, having spent 2 months working on this. We want to get on with the business of what people have elected us to do and focus on. And as Minister for Education, it's special education, it's supporting children with disadvantage.
Well, Minister,
doing all of those
issues. We'll have to leave it there and we will see what happens tomorrow. Thank you very much for coming in. That's Minister Helen McEntee.
Text 51551 today with Clare Byrne on RTE Radio 1.